Hey, everybody, I'm Sheldon Fetty. I'm an alcoholic. First of all, I don't know who is responsible for lunch. Who put work into putting lunch together? He's still in the back. Well, when he comes in, no matter where we're at in the middle, let's just give him a round of applause, because wasn't that great? Right? I think that was great. We're going to get him. So we're going to go. Yeah! Woo! And I understand you just celebrated a year. That's great that you're in service and you're doing the right stuff, and you got a shot, regardless of what Amanda says. I think you got a shot. So this is a fun thing for Don and I to do. I love doing these ask a basket kind of things. I want you to know, and I mentioned this yesterday, but I want you to know that what you got here with Don and I, and I think that Don will agree, we've talked about this in the past, that it's so important as you go to these AA conferences that you understand, that I understand as a presenter, and that you understand as a listener, that you don't have guys up here with deep insight or great knowledge or that are somehow spiritual giants, okay? You got a couple of knuckleheads. That one of the gifts that God has given us, and it is a gift, is the ability to string words together and make them sound pretty. And that is the extent of our gift. Now, I've been doing this for a little over 21 years. Don's been doing this for over a quarter of a century. Obviously, along the way, unless we're completely insane, we're going to pick up a little insight and a little knowledge and a little bit of experience that we get to weave through our ability to communicate and to put ideas into words. So as we do the book study, and as we talk about the big book, we're just guys that have the ability to communicate. And as we answer these questions, I don't want anybody to think that you're getting the right answer. You're getting an answer, right? And it's the answer that at this moment, while I stand behind this microphone, I believe is the right answer. But if you ask me the same question last year or next year, you might get a different answer. Because this is an experience. This is a journey that we're on together. So if you have anybody has any other questions, there's I think more time than there are questions. And if anybody's moved to ask a question they didn't write down and you want to, you know, just kind of raise your hand or something, feel free to add a question in the mix that way also, if that's okay. So I'm just going to pick one out at random. I'll answer it first, and then I'll give the same question to my friend Don, and we'll go back and forth like this. Suppose you get a transfer sponsee. Do you start over in the steps? Call every day, meet once a week, et cetera, et cetera. That's a great question. I have the blessing of, I would say, more than half the guys I sponsor these days are not guys that are brand new. They're people that have been around the program for a while, and they've come to me with a certain amount of sobriety, and maybe they've drifted away from their sponsor, or maybe they feel like they're stagnant and they just want to get a new experience. And I don't have a pat answer to that question. I sit down with the guy and have a conversation with them about their experience and where they're at. And I have three things that I want to know. The first thing that I want to know is, are they working with new people? Are they actively looking for new people that they can sponsor? Because, gosh, if you're not doing that in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're sober for a little while and you're not looking for opportunities to give this thing away, that's really a problem. And a lot of times when people are looking for a new experience, the new experience they're really looking for will be found with them taking new guys through the steps. That's really where the experience for them will happen. But the other two questions I have is, the first one is about inventory. You know, did you do an inventory? Did you come clean? Are there things in your life that currently are secrets that you haven't shared with anybody? Do you have any fresh new resentments that we need to talk about? If they do, then the next step that we're going to do is inventory. We're going to get right into writing inventory. And then the next question is what about amends? Where are you at in your amends process? Do you have amends that you haven't made? I make an assumption And as I say this, the assumption doesn't sound like it's right, which happens a lot in my life. But I make an assumption if somebody's sober for a little while that they have somewhat of an understanding of step one, not when it relates to the unmanageability of our life as we're living day to day, but the idea that drinking for them is probably a bad idea. And I make an assumption, and it may not be a good assumption, but I make an assumption that they're seeking God. And I make that assumption because they're coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I make the assumption that they're seeking God. So as far as our first initial meeting, you're new to me, you're sober while you're new to me, I'm going to ask you three questions. Are you working with new people? Do you have things, secrets that need to be inventoried? And or where are you at in your amends process? And then, of course, beyond that, we're going to spend time together. And as we spend time together, we're going to revisit step one and two and three and the rest of the steps. And I'm going to encourage you to be revisiting those as you take new people through the steps. So that's my experience, John.
Non-alcoholic? Don't have a lot to add to that, but a little twist on that. Quite often, somebody will come up to me, and they'll say, are you willing to sponsor me? And I'll say, well, let me ask you a couple of things. First, are you currently being sponsored? And almost always they say, yes, I am. And I go, okay, well, if you're currently being sponsored, how long have you been with this guy? And they'll say, you know, whatever length of time it is. And I'll say, well, why do you want to change sponsors? And then I get the list of what the sponsor's doing wrong and how they're spiritually falling down on their program of action and how they're not available and they're not this and they're not that. And I don't think that he's taking my sobriety seriously and I'm having trouble connecting with him and not. And when they get done with that, I go, wow, that really does sound like a problem. What does your sponsor have to say about that? And they'll go, what are you talking about? And I go, well, you just did a really job. You didn't even have to really think about it much. That stuff just flowed like a waterfall. Well, you've told them, right? Well, no. Oh, that's a problem. Listen, what I'd like you to do is go back to your sponsor, and I want you to tell them exactly what you just told me. Well, I don't know if I could do that. Why? I said, don't you think you owe them that at least to let them know there's a problem? Maybe there's another side of the story you don't know. And the reason I bring that up is about 50% of the time when the person goes back to their sponsor and tells them what they just told me, they work it out and they continue in their relationship. It's very important that people understand that sponsors are human and sometimes they're not on their A game. Sometimes they're neglectful and they don't mean to be. Sometimes they have, I know this is shocking, they have other things in their life besides us. It's not always all about me. It should be, but it's not always about me. So I always try to encourage people to make sure that their sponsor and them, that they have their sponsor's blessing to look for another sponsor. Now, if it's something where somebody's moved, they've moved into the area, they're looking for somebody locally, and one of the things was, do you have them call every day? Do you go through the steps again? I don't, you know, for me, the first thing I do when I get a new sponsee is I have them over to the house. It's job one. I ask them, do you eat? And they go, well, yeah, I eat. Good. What do you like to eat? And they tell me, I go, good. And we make an appointment, say, come over for dinner. And we'll sit down and we'll share a meal. And we won't talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. We won't talk about the steps. We won't talk about anything. We'll just share a meal. And then we'll just hang out and we'll just talk and we'll get to know each other a little bit. And in that process, I'll introduce the questions as Sheldon eloquently talked. I want to find out where he's at in his current program. But I almost always, if I don't know somebody, I want to go through the steps. I may go through them very quickly. We may go through, because this is what everybody always says. Do you have any active resentments that you're eating your lunch? No, I'm good. Okay. Yeah. Do you have any amends that you owe? No, not really. I think I'm all up to date. Of course you are. Well, I guess you should be sponsoring me then. But what I like to do is I like going through the process because if that's true, it's going to be really quick. It's going to be really lightning quick. It doesn't take very long. You can do it in an afternoon. But what usually happens in that process is the resentment starts showing up. The unmade amends start showing up. And the thing about calling, I do this with everybody I sponsor because it's done with me. It's always been done with me. Monday through Friday, you call every day. If you got anything on the weekend, the guys know I travel. You're welcome to call me on the weekend. I'll get back to you as soon as I can, you know. But the reason that we do that is we find as men, and I can't speak for women, but I can just speak for the men, that it's easier for me to do something every day than remember to do it once a week or when I'm in trouble. I have a work habit that I've developed over years that I just call my sponsor at a certain time, around a certain time, about midday, Monday through Friday. And it's the check-in call. And most of the time I call in, I'm just like, hey, man, I'm just checking in, nothing going on, just out working, just wanted to check in. He's like, great, have a good day, and that's it. But the thing is, because of that work habit, that when things do happen in my life, there's no hesitancy to call my sponsor. So I try to instill that with the guys I work with. And here's the other thing. Guys don't always call every day. You know, it's, I look at it as, if you can't make a 30-second phone call once a day, how are you going to be able to do the other things in AA? But I understand we get busy, whatever. I meant to call. I set an alarm on my phone. I still didn't call. I call guys all the time. If I sponsor you and I don't hear from you, I call you. You know, this is a shoulder-to-shoulder deal for me. This isn't like, well, I'm the sponsor, you need to call me. If I haven't heard from a guy in a couple of days, I'll just call and I'll check in with them. And I'll say that. Haven't heard from you in a couple of days. I'm sure you're fine. Just wanted to hear your voice. Give me a call back. Let me know everything's good. Love you. That's it. Then I don't, because I'm selfish and self-centered. And the minute I'm thinking about you, that means I'm not thinking about me. We got to get back to thinking about me, so I'll call you. So that's all I got. Huh. Wait. Time going through the steps, how long do you say a newcomer takes through the steps? I think they're asking how long is it to take to go through the steps. 47 days. We tried to do it in 46. We were killing people all over the place. We went to 48 and we were losing about half of them. 47, great success rate. Okay. Fearless and thorough from the very start is our timeline. Fearless and thorough from the very start. Now, as we've gone through the steps so far, we've pointed out some indications of time as we go through the steps that are in the big book. And they talk about how quickly we go through this. Now, let's go historical. When Alcoholics Anonymous first started, what they used to do in Akron is they would pull you aside and they would take you upstairs to Dr. Bob's bedroom. They call it the third step bedroom. And until you could take the first three steps and take that third step on your knee with one of the members, there was no point in joining the other guys in the main room. That if you weren't convinced and ready to take those first three steps, there was no point in going on with the rest of the program. One of our co-founders, Dr. Bob, and his stories point out he made his amends his first day of sobriety. That's just his experience. So we're not suggesting you make your amends on your first day of sobriety. We're not saying that. But I think we think that somehow a prolonged experience with the steps will increase its accuracy and our proficiency with it. Now, and I would agree with that if it was a one-and-done deal. If this was a curriculum where I'm only going to go through it once in perfection, I better get it done right or I won't pass, then I think you should go through it slowly. But that's not what we're doing here. What we're trying to do is get introduced to these spiritual tools as quickly as possible so then we can go practice with them for the rest of our life. I don't think you have to worry about writing the perfect inventory. I don't think you have to worry about your level of sincerity as you go through the first three steps. I don't think you have to worry about if you really understand the deep spiritual significance of 6 and 7. And I don't think you have to worry about your amends other than that you made them. The only amends that are wrong are the ones you didn't make. A lot of us, if we had a time machine, we'd go back to certain situations with amends we've made, and maybe we would have done them a little differently. We do the best we can. But fearless and thorough from the very start is really what it is. We don't want to delay. And I'm just of that opinion on being here for quite some time and watching what happens with people that squander that huge resource we bring in, which is our desperation. Because what can happen here is physical sobriety can masquerade as recovery. You see, I come in here, I'm unemployed, I haven't worked in a year, I'm in bad health, nobody's talking to me, my life's in the crapper. Bill Wilson used to say, the good is the enemy of the best. So I will come in here and I'll get a job and I'll have some money in my pocket, like Sheldon says, and I'll get out of trouble in the family. Now they're talking to me and I'm going to work every day and I'm going to a lot of meetings and I'm feeling better because you've removed alcohol from me. And I'm going to a lot of meetings and I have meeting-based recovery, but I'm not into the steps. I'm going to do that, but I'm not doing that once. But what will happen eventually to a guy like me is the things that I think, I have a list in my mind. When I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and one list is the trouble I'm in. The other list is the things I've never had in my life that I'm sure if I had them, I'd be happy. So what happens in AA is I start taking care of that first list, all the trouble I'm in, because I know if that list is taken care of down the bottom, it says equals happy. And so what happens is I get out of debt and I pay back all that money and I clean up those warrants and I get to work and I start doing these things. And I'm surprised when all that's done, when all the trouble in my life, the consequences of my drinking are taken care of, it's better, but I can't really say I'm happy. And then I've got the other list in my mind that I think, man, if these things happen, I know I'd never have a bad day. Because I hear guys talk about falling in love and meeting the woman of their dreams. What would that be like? And becoming somebody that really has a career and makes a living, is able to pay their bills and really save up for the future and have a future. And they're like, what would that feel like? And maybe even become a homeowner and all these things I'd hear about, these blessings of life, these outside things that turn out don't have a lot to do with recovery from alcoholism. But I go and I get those things in my life and I'm surprised that they leave me feeling strangely hollow because I was so sure that they were the answer. And there's nothing wrong with those things, but when I hang my hat on that hook of recovery, I can find myself let down. So I think it's important that why somebody, you don't get your life together and now I'm ready for God. I am perfect for God in a new experience when I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, broken in half, because my willingness will never be higher than when I'm new. I mean, I like to think I'm a good card-carrying member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that way of my friend Sheldon. I would like to think if you ask me to do anything in AA, if I'm capable of doing it, I will say yes. That's my operative word. There's nothing I wouldn't do for AA. I would like to think of myself as a willing member. Having said that, the willingness that I possess today pales in comparison to the willingness I had my first 30 days. My first 30 days, I was doing stuff that a sponsor was telling me to do, and I didn't even know the guy yet. And why do I think that willingness was so far superior? I was taking actions I didn't know worked yet. I had no idea they actually worked, yet I was doing it anyway. It's much easier for me to do it today because I've had the change in my life. Not only do I believe in AA, I know it works because it's happened to me. I didn't know that when I was new. I think when we have these new people, we're so afraid to damage them. I don't think they're ready. I'm telling you, my guys, we get into the steps and we don't stop. Now, some people go through it faster than others, but we start and we don't stop. We keep moving forward. Most of the trouble I see people get into in early recovery is a direct result of stopping. I've never heard anybody go, yeah, he got drunk, what happened? I gotta tell you, he was working the steps way too hard. Oh my God, all he was doing was step, 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 and helping others and seeking God, and you know, no wonder he got, haven't heard it yet. Haven't heard it, so.
There was a line or a cliche that used to get thrown around a lot. You don't hear it very much anymore, which I'm grateful for. But people would say a lot in meetings when I first got sober, slow is real. Yeah, right? Slow is real. And I got this lunatic for a sponsor. I mean, the guy's a crazy man, right? I meet him and I'm 3 days sober and he wants me to read the doctor's opinion. I mean, he's like, I read that and the next thing you know, I'm reading There Is a Solution and then more about alcoholism. I'm less than a week sober and this crazy man's got me reading 60 through 63 and he's rushing me through the steps and I feel like I'm just being like hurtled along. And I went to this other old timer, guy's name was John. I said, this guy, I don't understand. Everyone in the meetings is telling me slow is real. There was a thing people used to say, one step a year, right? You need to do one step a year. Very important that you don't go any faster than one. And I go, John, this guy's killing me. I'm not even 30 days sober yet, and he's got me writing my inventory. And the old Ty John laughed. He said, you know, he said, you got to imagine that you're a drowning man. In Vegas, just outside of Vegas, we got Lake Mead, huge, big, deep lake. He said, imagine you're in Lake Mead, and you're drowning, and you're treading water, and you're able to keep just above the surface of the water. How long can you tread water for? When do you want the life preserver? Do you want us to throw it to you now, or do you want us to wait a little while? Some people have some strength that I don't have. there are people that I've met in Alcoholics Anonymous that are able to stay sober just on meetings. And they're able to put up with the emotional pain, and that what I would call being a dry drunk, they're able to just, they can stay sober and they're fine. I'm not that guy. 30, 60 days, I'm gonna need some kind of relief. But even the people that are able to stay sober without doing the work, why would you want to do that? You know, we talk about meeting-based sobriety, and the cliche that you will hear a lot of meeting makers make it, you know, meeting makers make it. And then we talk in this kind of a fellowship, we talk about how that's nonsense. You got to do, I don't mean to make it sound like meetings are a bad idea. They're a wonderful idea. Our friend Paul said the funniest thing. First time I heard him say this, I thought, that's spot on. He says, a lot of meetings make it easy. Few meetings make it hard. No meetings make it impossible, right? And I believe that. I think meetings are really important. We shouldn't down-talk meetings so the newcomer thinks, well, I'm only going to one meeting a week. They're crap anyway. Who cares, right? I mean, we want to encourage people to attend meetings. But just to attend meetings isn't enough. And the Big Book gives this timeline. It talks about next we launched in step four. And at the end of step five, it says, go home and rest for an hour, right? It's giving you this idea of a timeline. I did my inventory with my sponsor. I happen to remember I was 27 days sober when I shared my fourth step with my sponsor. And I think if I'd have waited much longer than that, I might not have made it. But here's what I watch happen. And here's why I encourage guys to do the steps as quickly as possible. When I first show up at Alcoholics Anonymous, I know I did it. I mean, I'm new. I showed up here. I got this all-important desperation that Don's talking about, and boy, I'm dying, and it's my fault, and I'll do it. But as I work through these lists that he's talking about, and you know, you show up to work a couple, three or four days in a row, you get a paycheck or two, you get three hots and a cot, you know, you eat a little, sleep a little, you wash some clothes, take a shower, you start to feel better. And after a little while, you start to feel so much better just from physical sobriety that you start to think, well, you know what, I got this now. The problem is that I still got the resentments. So I'm still angry at my mom, my dad, my boss, my wife. I'm still frustrated with my son, my neighbor, my coworkers, the people in AA. And if I stay sober for too long without working an inventory, what will become apparent to me and impossible to change, or very difficult to change, is that I'm sober, I'm doing well, but you're all idiots, and it's no longer my fault, and it becomes your fault. And once in my mind clearly solidified is that it's not my fault, it's your fault, it's a very difficult thing to turn around. And then if I do stay sober, I'm not happy about my sobriety. But I have learned one thing, and it says it in the book also, in working with others. I don't pressure guys. I meet guys at their point of willingness. I tell them my experience. My experience is you need to do the steps as quickly as possible. My experience is that if you're not actively working on the next step, then you're stagnant. And in nature, you're either growing or you're dying. And if you ain't growing, I got news for you, you're dying. And I encourage people to do more. But if a guy doesn't want to do more, I don't push him. I say, look, this is my experience. This is what I think you should do, but I'm not going to browbeat you or bully you. The book warns against if we push a guy too hard, and then he doesn't stay sober for a myriad of different reasons, then he'll start to think that the steps are the problem, and we can do more harm than good, and the book warns us against that. So I'm an encourager. I'm not a bully. I'm a cheerleader. I'm not really a coach. I recommend and suggest you do more and you do it faster. But if you don't want to, I would rather spend my time on the guy that wants to than wasting my time on the guy that doesn't. So I hope that answers the question.
Yes, 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 yes.
I agree with you, Don. Do you agree with me, Don? Oh, yes. Don and I agree with each other, which is just, yes, 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 yes. I think you're wonderful. How do you feel about me? Fantastic. Good, good. This question is based on something that Don had said earlier on. Please discuss the spirit of the third and seventh step. Please discuss the spirit of the third and seventh step. So in step three, I get my sponsor's voice running around my head right now, and something he says all the time that I love. He says, step three is about simply this. It's about making my life none of my business. I'm going to get out of the way. I'm going to ask God to take over. I'm going to hand him the reins. I'm going to say, Pops, just you do it because I can't. And why would I say that? Well, you know, based on my experience, based on my life, if you're stood in the middle of my life, by the time I get to a point where I'm willing to take a third step honestly, I'm probably not doing so well. Most of us don't show up in AA and say this: work is great. I got this amazing career. I got a lot of respect. I'm making plenty of money. I love my boss. I love the people I work with. Everything is fantastic at work. Home life, unbelievable. Unbelievable. I mean, I got to tell you, my wife and I can't think of a time where we haven't both been horny on the same day. I mean, it's just, it's fantastic. She's a great cook. I love her. She does a great job with the laundry. House is clean. I mean, just unbelievable. My marriage is, the kids, you've never met children like mine. They are, I think at least one, if not both, will be saints before that. It's incredible. But I got this drinking problem. And other than the drinking, everything else is just fine. You know, typically the way we show up to AA is like more like this. Yeah, I know I drink too much, but that's not really the problem. The problem is her, it, them, the job, and if they just leave me alone, and I agree I drink too much. That's one of the problems. My life is just a disaster in every area. And so what I'm trying to say in step three is I'm trying to say, Pops, I've tried, and I can't. I've tried, and I can't. And in step four and five, I take a look at my life, and I identify why I can't. What is it about my reaction to life that makes it impossible? Why is it? We were talking at the break about one of our friends that's got this big button that his boss likes to push, right? Not only what are the buttons, but why do I put them there? Why do I polish them, and why do I make sure they function correctly, right? Because that's what I do. I am the manufacturer of the buttons, the maintenance guy of the buttons, and the janitor polishing the buttons. And if you talk to me long enough, part of the way through the conversation, I will say, oh, and by the way, I have this button here. And if you push it, you'll find it entertaining. So why do I have the buttons? What do the buttons do? How did I wire the buttons? What is it about the way that I run my life that makes everything a disaster? And then in step seven, I say to Pops, I say, hey, can you take the goddamn buttons away? Can I give you the buttons? Can you remove from me the things that are destroying me? You know, I'm not a Bible guy, obviously. What I really am, someone was asking me at the break, I'm not a practicing Jew. I love Eastern philosophy is the way that I read and study today. I'd like to be a Buddhist. I'm not, because I'm not that dedicated to anything. But if I had any more dedication in me, I'd be a Buddhist Jew. I'd be a Jubu, is what I would be. I'd like to be a Jubu. But in the Bible, there is a teaching that says that God will not do for you what you can do for yourself. And in step three, I say, God, do everything. And in step seven, I start to identify the things that I can do and should do myself and the things that I want God to do. And in step seven, I want God to remove from me the things that are blocking me from him.
Yeah, talking about the spirit of the third step and the seventh step. Well, for me, it's approach to what? How I live my life. When we say, you know, I have a spiritual approach to living, what does that mean? Well, the spirit of the third step for me is is offering myself, that I want to have this relationship with God. I don't even know what that means, and I don't know how to evoke that. I don't know how to get that done, but I'm willing to have this. I make a decision that I'm going to turn my will and life over to the care of God. The actions we talk about in 4 through 9 is how that happens. One way to look at it is, you know, the third step is your sponsor walks you over to the cliff, and there's an abyss there, and you look down, and you don't see anything. And about the time you're thinking there's nothing down there, your sponsor goes, jump. And you look again, and there's nothing there, and you turn to your sponsor, you go, you jump. And he smiles and goes, I already did. And you ask, well, what's going to happen? He goes, I have no idea, but we're going to stay and watch. And really, the third step, the real dilemma, the third step for me is I like the idea of a spiritual way of living. I like that based on the failure of my life and what I've already seen in Alcoholics Anonymous on people that have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. You make it look good. But there's this nagging question I can't answer, which is, what do I get? What do I get? What's in it for me? So what I'm really asking God in the third step is a question, and the question is, can I trust you? If I do this and I go on this journey, I'm risking everything. That may not seem like a lot when I'm new, but it's everything I've got. I'm talking about a big decision. I'm going to turn my will and life over to this power that I don't fully understand yet. So I'm asking God, can I trust you? And in the seventh step, after the work I've done, when I go back to God and I offer myself to him in service to him and his kids, God gets to ask me the same question. Can I trust you? And the answer is the same. When I ask God if I can trust him, God says yes. And by the time I'm at the seventh step, when God asks me that, I can say yes. You see, there's a difference between having a relationship with God and having a relationship with God that works. There's a difference between knowing that I should be of service and these things will serve me well and wanting to be of service. You see, when it becomes a spiritual piece of business that I want this relationship with God, that I want to be of service, that I want to approach my life that way, it's no longer work. And it felt like work in the beginning because it was so abstract for me. It was so unnatural. God, I got to remember to think of others. How do you do that? I couldn't remember to think of God. I mean, I'm the guy that has post-it notes in my mirror, inside my wallet, on the dash of my truck, everywhere you can see, and it just says the word God. I'm doing everything I can to remember just to think about God. But as we go through the steps, a lot of stuff in me gets taken care of. A lot of stuff gets rearranged in the way that it needs to be arranged. A lot of debris that's on the path between me and God gets cleared out of the way. And I'm starting to get a clearer message, and I'm starting to have a better life, and I'm starting to want this relationship. And so what's the approach? What's the spirit? What do I carry in me as I go through the day? I want to serve God and his kids. I want to understand the nature of my relationship with God, which is he's management and I'm labor. And I'm okay with that. I want to understand. I remember being confused about this service to others and going to my first sponsor and saying, I understand I have to help people, but there's so many people. And who deserves it? Who doesn't deserve it? Who am I supposed to help? How will I know? And he said, oh, Don, God made you. He knows everything about you, and he knows you're not that bright. So the people you're supposed to help, he's going to make it easy on a guy like you. He's going to put them right in front of you. So when you find somebody standing right in front of you, be assured that God put that person there at this point in space and time, and your only job is to try to be helpful to them. And I've never forgotten that. And there have been times in my sobriety where I found myself with a guy standing in front of me. And this is what I thought. This one too, God? This one too? So I hope that answers that a little bit for you. He's going to answer that next. Okay. In your home groups, are there more open or closed meetings, and why does our group choose one over the other? God, I got a great, all right, I got to be careful. All right. I'm going to step into the muddy waters of opinion here, but that's all I've got to deal with. Open and closed meetings. So first of all, I'm assuming everybody understands what the difference between an open and closed meeting. All right. In where I live, there are mostly open meetings. There are a couple of closed meetings. All right. My home group, when I first started attending it, was a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a big fan of closed meetings, and this is why. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know what I was. I had an extensive drug background, which up to this point, I have not spoken of, you've noticed. I have very little difficulty honoring singleness of purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been speaking from podiums in Alcoholics Anonymous all over the country for over 10 years plus. I've been given main talks in AA since I was 2 years sober. I've never talked about drugs. It's not difficult for me. I had the old timers tell me that this is AA, we talk about drinking, we don't do that here. No, I got no problem. I'm just a guest at your party. I want to be a good guest. I'll follow the rules. I got no big deal. I find it interesting that people that have a problem with singleness of purpose say things. I've had guys I sponsor that have find it necessary to talk about drugs and Alcoholics Anonymous, for example. They'll say, hey, man, it's just my story. And I'll go, well, yeah, but I've heard your fifth step. I know parts of your story you don't share in AA. So it's very funny how we'll pick and choose what we're going to share in Alcoholics Anonymous. But my opinion about the closed meetings is I think the closed meetings in the beginning in Alcoholics Anonymous were created for one reason only. We understood that meetings were open to the press. They were open to family members. They were open to the clergy. They were open to anybody, the medical community. Anybody that had an interest in Alcoholics Anonymous could come to an open meeting and they could observe what happened in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, because of the spirit of anonymity and because we had members, it was very important to them, particularly in our early days, that their membership remained secret, that it may have hurt them in their professional life. If people were to find out they were a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, they might have been judged harshly. Business rivals might have used it against them. Anonymity was very, very important to these people. So they went to closed meetings where they were assured that everybody in that meeting was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a comfort in that for them. But what I think the closed meeting has morphed into in later years in Alcoholics Anonymous is some type of defense system, wall that we've put up to make sure that the evil drug doers don't end up in AA. And what we're trying to do is control our environment in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't want to hear a bunch of drug talk. I don't want to hear a bunch of junkies in there talking about their stuff. So we want to make sure that everybody that arrives in Alcoholics Anonymous is an alcoholic of our kind, that we can approve of that type of loser, you know. So I start going to this meeting, and it's a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So the very first inventory our group had, I asked the question. I go, why are we a closed meeting? And nobody could really answer it. And one guy said, okay, well, to be honest, we have a closed meeting because we didn't want a bunch of drug talk in our meeting. Now, I'd been going to the meeting for about a year at that time. And I said, well, guys, let me tell you a secret. It ain't working. You may be a closed meeting, but we occasionally hear guys talking about drugs. That happens at Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is my concern. If we really believe in what we have, and we really think we have something to offer the still suffering alcoholic, are we going to close ourselves off? Are we afraid that somebody that perhaps isn't an alcoholic is going to come into our meetings and corrupt it? But are we keeping the guys out of AA that haven't gotten the proper diagnosis yet? You see, when I came to AA, I hadn't had a diagnosis. I didn't know if I was an alcoholic. I didn't know if I was a drug addict. I didn't know what I was. I had a lot of trouble in my life because of both of those areas. Until I got a sponsor and started going through the work in the book, primarily in the doctor's opinion, I didn't know what I was. And when I read the doctor's opinion with a sponsor, we started looking at the phenomena of craving, the allergic reaction, the obsessive mind, the spiritual malady. I went, oh my God, that's it. I'm an alcoholic. And I identified with the description of alcoholism contained in the doctor's opinion, and I've never looked back. I am so grateful that when I arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous, September 16th, 1991, I showed up at an open meeting. Because if I had showed up at a closed meeting and someone at the door said, hi, this is a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, we need to know, are you an alcoholic or are you a drug addict? What are you? I would have said, I don't know what I am, man. I'm just trying to get the heat off. And they said, well, if you can't say you're an alcoholic, you can't come in, you'd have a different speaker this weekend. Because I didn't have the strength to sit and debate. I was able to get into a room and just be left alone and have a safe place to be for a little bit until they 12-stepped me my second night of recovery. Thanks.
I was concerned that we weren't going to have enough questions to fill the hour, and then I remembered it's Don and I. So this question says, Sheldon, last night you said that Bob told you to stop having a way. How do you stop having a way? Anybody? I'd like to open this one up to the floor. Anybody got any ideas? The point of the question, when it was asked to me, and the point of the answer, when it was told to me, and the point of the question and the answer when I say it to guys that I sponsor, isn't that there is a way to accomplish that. It's what you have to realize is the problem. I mean, I can't not have a way. I can't not have an opinion. It's impossible for me not to have judgment. It's impossible for me not to want things. I have a great life. We have a beautiful home. There are problems. It's a little small, to be honest. I mean, the carpet's it could use some things, right? My business is okay. I want more. I want more of everything. The point of the question and the point of the answer is for me to realize that when those things get out of control, that when the fear that I won't get enough creates the resentment and the separation, the understanding of what the problem really is. Nobody expects me, and I don't expect anybody, to turn into this automatron that walks around where everything's fine, everything's fine. I got sick. Good. God did it. Must be good. Oh, we're going out of business. Let's have a sale. We'll have a going out of business. Good. Good. Everything's good. That's not the point. The point is for me to identify the angst, because here's how I've always lived my life. In angst and your fault. In angst and your fault. And hopefully the lesson that I can learn in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I'm in angst and I'm a volunteer for it. I'm in angst and I'm the guy that's creating the angst. And just to the extent that I can try and submit to God's will to say, you know what, things are the way they're supposed to be, just to that extent is the extent that I'll have serenity and peace. But I think that it's an old joke I'm going to try and change, and we'll see if we can change it to make it work. We'll give it a shot. There are two kinds of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those that struggle because they don't get their own way, and liars.
How do you specifically connect with God? A lot of people don't know this. It involves the left elbow. We start with the left elbow. A lot of people think it's the knees because of prayer. It's not. There's so much to do. Specifically, anytime, anywhere, I want. I'll show you. God, I know you're here right now. We are having an awesome time in Alabama. These people are so kind and so sweet. And I got to tell you, I didn't want to come this weekend. I got a lot going on in my life. I've been really busy, as you know. I'm glad you let me know it was a good idea to be here. I'm so glad I have friends that thought enough to invite me and Sheldon. You know, we're having a great time. I'm wondering, where would I be if not here? What are the little people doing today? I'm having an outstanding time. Thank you for allowing me to be wrong one more time in my life. That's how you connect with God. Anytime you want, anywhere. Come on.
So we just learned that the short answers are the true answers. Which means I haven't told the truth all weekend. the answer to the question, I agree with Don, isn't just anytime, anywhere. It's actually specifically now. Now. You can't make an appointment to get with God. The answer is now. It's the only place he exists. How do you know when you should or if you should change sponsors? It's a great question. I've had the same sponsor since my entrance in Alcoholics Anonymous. Next month will be 22 years. I was a week sober when I met Bob. During that time, we've had an amazing relationship. He's more like a father to me than my own dad was. I'm in love with the guy. We've had businesses together. We've owned businesses together. Gone on vacations together. We've shared holidays together. We've laughed together and we've cried together. And as in any relationship, a couple of times, I've wanted to kill the SOB. I wish that I could tell you, but that's all about 10 years in the past. But as Don so well knows, the end of last year, beginning of this year, there was separation between me and my sponsor. And it was very uncomfortable for me. And I was going to change sponsors. And that was very scary for me because I've had the same sponsor for 2 decades. So I call up a guy and I say, hey, I think I want to change sponsors. And you know, it's a funny thing. We're funny people. Some guys you ask that, you say that to, and it's like they're collecting sponsees. So they're glad for the call and they just want to be helpful. But thankfully, the guy that I called was Don. And Don asked me those questions that he talked about 15, 20 minutes ago. And I wrote an inventory, one that I could not share with my sponsor, because it just had his name on it. And I flew up to the spiritual center of the Northwest, to Bellingham, and I shared that inventory with Don. Here's my experience, having been sponsored by the same guy for over 2 decades. There's a couple of things that have happened when him and I have struggled and I felt like it's time for me to change sponsors. More so early on, but also in current times, when I feel like I need to change sponsors, it's because he's giving me direction that I don't agree with. And I don't want to take the direction. And so instead of talking about the direction and working it out and figuring out, hey, and then taking the direction anyway, being sponsorable, taking the direction that I'm given. Because otherwise what I'm saying is that my life was unmanageable, but now it is manageable and I'm taking back the reins. So instead of that, what I do is I start to look closely at his life. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. If you follow me around with a notebook and a list of principles, trust me, it will not take you very long to decide I'm not the guy you want to take direction from. I am flawed and I am broken and I make mistakes. And it is the reality of me. But when my sponsors give me direction that I don't want to take, in order to defend myself from not taking that direction, I'll get out my magnifying glass and start watching him in his life so I can character assassinate him and come up with reasons why I don't need to take his direction. And that's what happens to me. And then I end up with, this guy's no good, he's a bum, he's not even doing AA himself, for God's sakes, right? Because what's happening is I'm being given direction that I don't want to take. I'm being asked to step up to the plate in Alcoholics Anonymous to a level that I don't want to step up to the plate. The other thing that has happened in my life, and this is what has happened more recently in Alcoholics Anonymous, this is what the cause of my recent angst was mostly, is that we'll find a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous that we respect. And we like him, And so we start to build a little pedestal for them. No big deal. I mean, they're your mentors. There are giants in AA that I look up to and that I adore. And I will build a pedestal for my mentors. But I'm an alcoholic, so it needs to be a little bit bigger of a pedestal. And I build it a little bigger, and I build it a little higher, and I sharpen the top a little, and I take the podium where they're supposed to stand, and I make it a little smaller. And I make this tall, tall pedestal with an itty-bitty little platform that nobody could possibly ever stand on. And then I judge them when they fall. And this is what I do in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is what I do. I would say that the only time really for you to change sponsors, and there are exceptions to this, there are exceptions to this, but when for some reason your sponsor becomes because of distance or work life or job life or family life, where they become inaccessible and you can't possibly get a hold of them and your lives don't mesh anymore, that would be a time. Or when in agreement with your sponsor, you're going through things that your sponsor says you can get more help, you can grow more without me. And that in conversation with your sponsor, it seems like the right next healthy step for you. But I will tell you, the only time you should not leave your sponsor is when it's based on resentment and fear. That whatever you do first, whether you change sponsors or not, that you find a way through the resentment and the fear. And tongue in cheek, and joking a little but not really, I would tell you, just knock it off and take the goddamn direction they're giving you. And you might find you don't need to change sponsors. Let's come back at 10 after 2, guys, and we'll move on. 10 after 1. No, 2. What time is it?